And we shall begin. So take out your notes. Who read all the way to chapter 4? All right, good. You got to read till chapter 10 of Fox's Book of Martyrs by Monday. So make sure you're working on that. Today we're going to do a little introduction, so get out your notes. Y'all ready? The first thing we need to understand is that ever since God promised Eve that to her would be born a Messiah that would crush the head of the serpent, from that moment on, there began a war between two kingdoms. Two kingdoms. Right. You read any books that sounds familiar with? Two kingdoms?
The one we just finished?
Narnia?
Sounds very similar to Narnia, to Fellowship of the Rings.
Jean-Jacques Rousseau.
Maybe. We'd have to think about that. But there's the kingdom of Satan and the kingdom of heaven, right? Jesus said he will build his church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. That means the gates of hell cannot stop Jesus's advance. But ever since that beginning, when God put enmity between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, there's been a war. In the book of Revelation, the war is pictured as a dragon fighting a woman in a great vision. The dragon fighting the woman. So with every war, oh, by the way, is that war still going on today? Absolutely. Jesus Christ is advancing to rule, to extend his rule over all the nations. He advances on a white horse with a sword coming from his mouth. That's the imagery in Revelation 19. But he is advancing. We are his soldiers. And what is a song we sing every morning in chapel? We are more than conquerors. That's right. We are the church militant, advancing forward, not with the weapons of this world, but with the weapons of the gospel and prayer and good deeds, etc. But with every war, there are those who are on the front lines. You can think of a war in the Middle Ages or, you know, an early American war where some bodies have to volunteer to charge the gap in the wall. You know, somebody's got to volunteer to charge and to go over the wall first. And what usually happens to those people?
They die.
What happened to the Greeks at Thermopylae when 300 Greeks stood against the advancing Persian army? What happened to them? They all died. Y'all remember that story from earlier. When the German Luftwaffe, that's their air force, was bombing and invading England, the Royal Air Force, the RAF, took to the skies and defeated them soundly, but many of them lost their lives. You see, the Bible's filled with a lot of people who are willing to put themselves out there and be first into the battle. Can you think of any examples?
Jesus.
Well, Jesus, of course. What about when the armies of Israel were arrayed against the armies of the Philistines and the Philistines brought out their champion, Goliath?
David,
that's right. David was willing to stand in the gap. Who was it that sought to go to Jerusalem to build the walls of Jerusalem and to face peril to advance the cause of Christ? What was his name?
Nehemiah,
that's right. And the priest Ezra. The Bible is filled with these heroes that are on the front lines, Gideon, and Deborah, and Samson. And very often the people on the front lines, the people that are first into the battle, they die. And it's through their advances that other people then can advance. Make sense? If you're first on the scene, you're going to make probably the greatest sacrifices, right? I think of the people who established this school. They didn't get to have all of the many things that we have today. Right? And in 50 years, when there's gyms and classroom buildings and football teams and a culture and a huge community built up around the school so that everyone has friends, countless friends, and They will have to thank for all of that the people who started this school with five little students risking everything, right? But the people who begin a work are always the ones who sacrifice the most. And the first century Christians were no exception. Thank you. That's right. So that's what John Fox is writing about in this book, Fox's Book of Martyrs. He's writing to honor those people who were first into the battle, willing to charge, willing to die, willing to sacrifice for the cause. He's writing to honor them. And so when you read it, you're going to feel honor and respect toward them as well. And gratitude, right? You should feel gratitude for all they've done for you. But also he wants to inspire you, because this might be you as well. Right? This might be you as well. The world is going through a huge transition, it seems right now. And you might be the vanguard, the advanced forces as this world continues to change. We'll talk about that more in a little bit. Let's talk about the author a bit. So if you want to click down in your notes, new subheading, the author, John Fox. Remember to use your bullet formats, Times New Roman, 12 font. He was born in 1516 in Lincolnshire. That's right next to the Hobbitshire. Lincolnshire, 1516 in England. And he died in 1587. So if you live in the 1500s in England, what sort of historical movements and events are taking place? You should know this.
Reformation.
That's right, the Reformation. The Reformation is on the way. So that's sort of the backdrop of his entire life. The world is changing. Does anyone know some of the key elements that initiated the Reformation? Yeah, John Wycliffe and his translations, that's right.
Inquisition.
No, not yet. The biggest one, the printing press. That's right, the printing press. Like before the printing press, very few people had books and pamphlets and Bibles. Bibles were so expensive that they chained them to the pulpit in the church. But with the printing press, now you could print materials, teaching materials, and spread it all over the world. And that began to change things. People began to get a hold of these materials and began to read the Bible for the first time. Then you see people translating the Bible in their own language. There's political upheaval. There's corruption in the papacy. All of the above. And the Reformation breaks out. And John Fox is in the middle of it. He's born like right in the middle of it.
When was John Fox born?
1516. He was a teacher, he was a scholar, and when he became a Protestant, he was fired from his job, basically. But not only fired, he had to flee from England because Mary I was persecuting all the Protestants. And we'll talk about what the Protestants were in a second. And while he was in exile from England, that's when he began writing the history of all the Reformation persecutions. So he started writing about people like John Huss and Wycliffe and the Lollards. Those are the people you're going to be reading about. All these people were persecuted by the Roman Catholics in England. That's when he began working on it. When he came back from exile, because as you know, the English wars went back and forth, Catholic and Protestant, etc. When he finally came back, he continued to add to the stories. He investigated. People would send him letters with more stories in them, and he would correct some of the details and add more to the stories. He was a historian, and so he was keeping all of these records. And he spent the rest of his life adding to this. He added the stories from the past all the way back to the disciples. And people are still adding stories to this day. I think in your edition, it goes all the way up to 2020, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, 2001.
2001. So people are still adding stories to his book. Close enough. This book was, remember we did Pilgrim's Progress. What was, it was pretty famous, right? What did we say? What was the little interesting fact about that, Benjamin?
It was the second most popular book in history.
Second most published book in human history. Second only to the Bible, that's right. Well, this book was so influential in England, it was written in English, that the queen, the Protestant queen, ordered that it be chained to the pulpits too, right next to the Bible. Like she printed an official copy, royal copies, and had them printed and chained to the pulpits. She wanted all the people and all the pastors to read the stories of how Protestants and Christians had been persecuted. So William Shakespeare read this. I mean, this was a very, very influential book. But the biggest thing is that it, because it was written in English, it solidified the English people in their hatred and opposition to the Roman Catholics. And that was good because, as you well know, England went back and forth there for a while. England had more violence and upheaval during and after the Reformation than probably any other country. And so as you read these tales of people being tortured by the Roman Catholic hierarchy, you start to solidify yourself as a Protestant, protesting. Right, some of you, you read already, so you know, who are some of the heroes in the book that you've already read about?
The
disciples, yeah.
Jesus,
yeah. Stephen, yeah. The biblical martyrs.
Justin
martyr. That's right. Wycliffe, you already got
to
Wycliffe?
Today,
did anyone get to the section on Polycarp?
Uh-huh.
Doesn't he have a famous saying from the Colosseum with the lions? Well, you'll get to that soon. Ignatius, Bishop Ridley, Archbishop Cranmer, you're going to get to him. These are some of the heroes. Archbishop Cranmer, he folded under the pressure and he signed documents to recant his faith. You know what that means? Like he denied Christ, signed it. But later he came under so much conviction after ever seeing everyone else stand strong for the faith, you know, rush in the gap and be courageous and sacrifice for the cause. He started seeing so many other people doing it that he felt guilty, and he took his recantation back. He repented, and he was sent to the fires to be burned. And as he approached the fire, he plunged his hand into the fire so that the hand that signed the signature would be burned first. It's crazy. There's a lot of stories like that. I think of Bishop Ridley, if I remember correctly. Bishop Ridley and one other man were persecuted together, and they were as they were burning, They said something like, and you're going to read it, I can't think of the exact quote off the top of my head, but something like, "Play the man, Master Ridley." Like, be courageous, be a man. "For today we will light a candle in Europe that will blaze for centuries." Something like that. So they saw themselves as standing in the gap, as being the first on a new frontier, making the way for people in the future. You see, does that sound like any other group that we've studied so far?
The Pilgrims.
The Pilgrims, that's right. These Protestants, that's what they're called, Protestants, and we'll talk about why that is in a little bit. But they were basically Puritans. They wanted to purify the church. And so you see some of the same attitudes that the Pilgrims had. Now, do you think that they thought the world was going to end at any minute and Jesus was about to return? Or did they think that Jesus was advancing over the ages and there was still a foundation to be laid for the future? That's right. See, they believed that they were laying a foundation. If you don't believe you're laying a foundation for the future, if you think any second now Jesus is going to rapture you out, well, you don't work in the same way. But if you know that you are establishing a foundation for future generations, you do. You work differently. You have a different passion, a different zeal, and you see that in these Protestants. You're going to read about some of the villains as well. Have you read about any villains thus far? Who? Roman emperors. Nero. Nero, by the way, this is a freebie, is the beast in the book of Revelation.
Thank you.
The number of his name is 666. That's Nero. John was writing about him, and it came true. And then the emperor Diocletian, one of the worst, coming after him. Caligula. That's right. Vespasian and his son Titus. the corrupt popes, the evil governors, the evil sheriffs, all of those people. You're going to read about all these different persecutors. The Inquisition, you're going to read about the Inquisition, frying people alive. Ugh, it's pretty brutal. But the thing you really need to understand for this class and just for your life is a little bit about the Reformation. So let's talk about the Reformation for a second. That's the cultural setting that this book was unfolding in and that Fox lived in. The Reformation was a war between the kingdom of Satan and the kingdom of light, obviously, but it was in many ways a war between the established Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants. All right, what does Protestant mean?
Protesting.
Protest, the protesters. So they're Puritans. They're not trying to separate. They're not trying to divide the church. What are they trying to do? Sure. Purify the church. And they're protesting the abuses and the heresies of the church hierarchy. Do y'all know what that means? The officers, the popes, the bishops, the cardinals, the magistrates. They were incredibly corrupt. One of the corrupt things they did was selling indulgences. Y'all learned about that before, haven't you? Didn't y'all study the Reformation last year in humanities?
We talked about Martin Luther.
Martin Luther. Do you remember the indulgences?
Yes.
What was the John Tetzel?
Yeah.
He traveled around Europe selling indulgences. When a coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory flings. Springs, sorry. It's a translation into English anyway. He wasn't speaking English. So Martin Luther, though, you know, he nailed his 95 theses to the wall. He's protesting all of the heresies in the church. One of the things he writes is, if the Pope can free people from purgatory, why doesn't he just go ahead and free the whole thing? Why doesn't he free everyone? And the answer is because the Pope was corrupt. He was charging people for their salvation in order to build his own empire. So that was going on during Fox's life. And what side of that battle would you have been on? The faithful or the corrupt? Well, hopefully the faithful, right? And Fox was a Protestant, so that got him fired and got him persecuted, and he had to flee, and he began to write about all the other people persecuting. Fox believed that the Pope was the Antichrist. That's mentioned by John in his in the book of 1 John. Y'all have heard of that phrase before, right? The Antichrist. The Pope is a Antichrist, but he's not the Antichrist. In fact, there is no the Antichrist. It's a spirit or a doctrine, if you read the text carefully. But the Pope is definitely anti-Christ. He was against Christ. He was evil. And so Fox wasn't all wrong. Some of the issues they faced, does anyone remember from class last year? What are some of the issues that they were really fighting about in the Reformation?
The Pope not letting the common people read the Bible.
Yeah, sola scriptura, and the belief that the Bible is the only authority, not the church, and that the Bible should be translated into the common language of peoples. That's right. Is everyone paying attention? Everyone listening? Benjamin, what are some of the other issues?
Demanded to tithe.
Demanded to what?
Tithe.
Well, tithing is a law in the Bible, but you mean paying indulgences.
Yeah.
Yeah, paying indulgences to be saved. That, of course, is corruption. What about the Lord's Supper? Wasn't there something with the Lord's Supper?
They said that it was actually Jesus' blood and body.
Yeah, they believed in transubstantiationism. You should write that down. Transubstantiationism. It's spelled just like it sounds. But it's like substances translating from one thing to another.
How do you spell that?
Transubstantiationism. Don't worry about spelling it perfectly now. We'll get it later. But you know those words from your Latin. You see it right in there, right? Trans. What's that mean? Moving from one to another, like translate, or a transitive verb. That's right. And they believe that the wine...
Transubstantiationism.
We'll get it later, okay? We're trying to record a lecture here. All right. They believe the wine turned into the actual blood of Jesus. And the bread, translated, turned into his actual flesh. So that when they partook of it, they were cannibalizing. Now, the problem with that is, Jesus was sacrificed once for all, right? Mm-hmm. On the cross of Calvary. What they believed is that Jesus was sort of reincarnated there and re-sacrificed. And they would bow to it. And bowing to something like that is what the pilgrims call idolatry. You see, that's the issue that we're dealing with here. And they fought over that. Transubstantiationism, by the way, comes from the philosophies of a Greek philosopher. And his name is?
Plato.
Not Plato, the other one, Aristotle. That's right. See, because in the 1200s, Aristotle had been translated into Latin and took Europe by storm. And much of the Roman Catholic Church apostatized because they absorbed Aristotle into their thinking. That's why Martin Luther said, "What does that pagan have to do with Jesus?" That's why all the reformers like Knox and Calvin and Zwingli and Luther said we need to get back to the sources. We need to get back to the Bible, not Aristotle. Right? Mm-hmm. We still have that problem today. People, instead of preaching the Bible, they preach pop psychology, marketing techniques, leadership skills, how to have your inner feelings locked in by tapping into the energy of the force God. This is the sort of stuff that is preached today, and it's people need to get back to the Bible, though. We have some of the same problems today. Of course, another issue in the Reformation was salvation by grace through faith, not faith plus works, but faith alone that produces works. That was another issue as well. And the last but not least, I want you to understand what Tertullian said. He said, the blood of the martyrs, write this down, Tertullian, T-E-R-T-U-L-L-I-A-N. Tertullian said, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Do you understand what that means? Can you get the imagery? Benjamin, help us explain it.
The death of the martyrs, it shows the people what people are dying for.
Yeah, God uses their death and their sacrifice to build his church. Their death and their courage and their sacrifice lays the foundation for future generations. That's right. That's why you see anywhere you see Christians being heavily persecuted, if you continue to watch, you will see Christians become the dominant cultural force soon enough. They were heavily persecuted in Rome, and by the Emperor Constantine, Rome became the official religion of the empire. You can't beat King Jesus. He is advancing, and he is going to rule over the nations with a rod of iron. They will either convert and worship or die. It doesn't matter how many Christians they kill. Yes?
Do you believe Constantine was actually a Christian?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know, obviously. It's for God to know the hearts of people. But I do think so. So, as you read, you're going to see people sacrificing. And it's going to be a little bit depressing and despairing. But you have to understand that with every martyr's death, it's a seed going into the ground that sprouts forth life. Right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to have courage as you read this. And you need to recognize that you could be like the martyrs in this book. You really could. I was thinking that last night when I was watching the news. The news is talking about nuclear war. Casually, just talking about it all the time. You know, there's war going on right now between Russia and the Ukraine. And there's people who have bombed the Nord Stream pipeline, cutting off a big supply of natural gas to Europe. And Russia has threatened to use nuclear weapons. And there are American civil leaders and politicians who have said things like, well, if they use nuclear weapons, we will bomb their fleets. And it's like, okay, these are pretty big weapons. You know, you might want to be a little bit more circumspect about this. It's not like the bombs that blew up Nagasaki and Hiroshima. They have bombs now that can blow up everything. Like, major restructuring of the world things could be taking place right now. And is there anything that has been recently invented that would rival the printing press in restructuring the way communication takes place? The internet. The internet, I believe, is more powerful and more monumental than even the printing press itself. The internet has changed everything. You know that in the time of Martin Luther, honestly, the time of Columbus, the time of Martin Luther, there was no Spain. There was no Germany. There was no, quote, England. There was no United States. None of those things existed. When Columbus sailed, he was not sailing for Spain. Spain didn't exist. He was sailing, in his mind, for Christendom. The world was structured completely differently. And there wasn't a Germany until the early 1800s. There wasn't a France until after Napoleon. You understand? Mm-hmm. The world was structured differently than what we think of now. If you look at a medieval map of Europe, for example, you can see that it's totally different. And the world could be restructured again, for sure. Things like the internet, nuclear war, social unrest, political upheaval. We could be in for another reformation. Now, the reason I say that is because I believe Jesus is advancing. He will build his church. And I know the prophecies of Scripture that show that Jesus will win and all the nations will bow to him, right? So, but what takes place before things like reformations? Well, sometimes, yes. But you remember when Martin Luther was persecuted and they were trying to kill him? Where did he hide?
In the Lord's
attic. Yeah, his governor protected him. How could his governor protect him when Wycliffe's governor could not and Huss's governor could not? What was going on? You see, what was going on is political changes were weakening the power of the Pope and the Holy Roman Catholic Emperor. Political changes were taking place that opened up new avenues for the gospel and the printing press, and it all came together in what we think of as the Reformation. Those sort of things can happen still to this day. And I do think that we are on the brink of another restructuring of what we think of as the map, and I think on the cusp of another Reformation, where we will see emerging from that. This is just my opinion. I can't know these things for sure, but we will see emerging from that a new Christendom, similar to what the old Christendom was, but different for a new world with airplanes and computers and internets and hoverboards, maybe, right? Something like that. All right. Well, let's go to lunch.